My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Balder Hagretz, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast. And today we are once again talking about Donald Trump and the tariffs that he has announced slash imposed. Balder, I feel a little bit bad towards the listeners simply because a few weeks both of us gave a big speech about we shouldn't overly focus on Trump, and we also need to look at the bigger picture, and focusing on Trump every week is actually a mistake. And now this is, I think, the fifth episode just in 2025 that we are recording on Trump.
Yeah, it reminds me of The Godfather 3, where Al Pacino goes, just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in. It feels like we're almost forced by the universe to do this. But there is a real problem with this. As you have pointed out to me privately, is that it works well for the algorithm. People want to listen to things about Trump, despite, on the other hand, people also saying, oh, I'm tired of hearing of him, right? It's one of those things that people say that they're tired of something, but they kind of are still attracted towards it. Now, in our case, the good thing is that we're not really chasing numbers because this is not monetized. It's not, we don't really worry too much about how many people are listening, but it is undeniable that if we weren't going to talk about Trump, if we were going to talk about something else extremely relevant, like Sudan or the Democratic Republic of Congo or the South China Sea, if we were to do that, then people would kind of feel that there's a gap, right? They would feel like, hang on, my brain can't focus on that now. I need to hear about the chaos that is unfolding in Washington. So it kind of leaves us without a choice. But it is very frustrating that this year, how many episodes have we done on Trump compared to any others?
As I said, I think it's five or six.
Yeah, five or six. Yeah, that is almost scandalous. But the universe leaves us no choice.
I also think there's a difference between what we said a few weeks ago, because that was right at the beginning of his term, right, with all these executive orders, and it was mostly with all these actions of the Department of Government Efficiency and others, where for a few weeks they were just like the same type of news came out in a slightly more shocking manner every day. But I do believe that with the Signal chat leak that we talked about last week, that was something completely different and it needed to be talked about. And these tariffs now, I think that they are so monumental, not only to the United States and what's happening in the United States, but also to the entire world, because these tariffs affect, what was it? I think about 170 or 180 countries, right? Almost all the countries in the world are being slashed with tariffs. So I think there's a slight difference between the situation we were in a month ago and the one we are in right now.
Yeah, you can't deny that in one day wiping $2.5 trillion off the stock market, people think, oh, those are just numbers, but those have real, that has real impact on real people's lives, right? It's not just that Jeff Bezos or others are losing a bit of their imaginary wealth. There's no doubt that what's happened over the past 4 or 5 days has been absolutely monumental and with real world impact. Now, the more important issue here is that these things are not singular instances, right? It kind of reminds me of your best friend Liz Truss, the shortest sitting prime minister of the UK. What was it, 46 days? You know these numbers better than I.
Well, it was basically she didn't outlast the lettuce.
She managed to tank the British economy by just completely irresponsible economic behavior. But it wasn't necessarily part of a bigger pattern. Well, maybe the pattern was incompetence of the Tory party and kind of a country that doesn't know where it's going. But it wasn't part of this bigger picture of Britain is breaking up with the rest of the world, is changing the way that the global relations are functioning or anything like that. Whereas these instances, the first couple of weeks and then Signal and now this, are really big things by themselves. But then they are also every time pushing us further off a cliff where the entire world order is just collapsing and we don't know what's coming next. And therefore, it is such a big thing. It's not just about the stock market. It's not just about economic destruction that is taking place in Washington. It is also about that picture of well, the world in 20 years' time is going to be completely different than how the 21st century started.
Actually, thank you so much for bringing that up, because I was thinking the other night about how can I provoke, or, well, not provoke, but like throw Baldur off his game this time, in this episode. And Liz Truss was a managerial mistake, right? And we always criticize that politicians, leaders, they shouldn't be managers. They shouldn't just focus on keeping unemployment down and keeping the markets happy and somehow keeping growth, but that it is more like it needs to be about more. Leaders need to have visions and they need to want to radically change the world. Well, here we have a leader who wants to radically change the world. I mean, I don't see the problem with this.
If this is your best shot at throwing me off my game, then you have to do better, Dario. I didn't know that you were thinking about me on Saturday evening, or, you know, trying to make life difficult. But the answer, of course, to what you're saying is there's a difference between managerialism and basic governmental competence. The argument that we've been making over and over again is that it's important for leaders to have a vision for the world, and that you can't just be a manager. You can't just say, I want to keep interest rates low, I want to keep inflation low, I want to keep unemployment high. That is not enough. And that has been one of the illnesses of Western governance over the past 30 years or so. But that doesn't mean that you can just throw a firebomb into your house and see what happens. You have to have good plans and a good vision towards the future, and then implement that with governmental competence. You have to know what you're doing, and you can't just create chaos for the sake of it. If certain visionary ideas require a little bit of chaos, then that might be acceptable. At the core, when Trump is saying, hey, globalization has been bad for American workers, then he has an interesting point and a fair point, and that might require some drastic change that creates a period of transition, of chaos, but you have to know what you're doing. You have to do it in the right way. And it's very clear that this White House doesn't know what they're doing. They don't have the basic competence necessary required to lead a country of the complexity of the United States, just like Liz Truss didn't know what she was doing. She had no idea how the economy worked, and therefore threw the British economy off a cliff as well.
So far we've already dropped a few hints throughout the episode what day we're recording. And I think this is actually even more important than usually to mention. So it is currently Sunday, the 6th of April, around 10 a.m. And this is off from our usual recording time, which is on Fridays. But on Friday, we were in a situation that the tariffs had been announced, I think it was somewhere 24 to 36 hours prior. And we didn't know any answers or any reciprocal measures by other countries. So we decided to move the recording to today, which was very good, because the moment we ended our call on Friday to prepare this episode, it came out that China announced its measures, right? So for the listeners, when you're listening to this on Wednesday morning, you know more than we do. You will most likely know the European response. For scheduling reasons, unfortunately, we couldn't push the recording even further. But that just for transparency reasons. And now I would say we kind of go back to what actually happened, in case any of the listeners said, oh, you know what, I don't want to read the news, I only listen to the Western bubble, because you kind of take all the hysteria out of news. On Thursday, Donald Trump, he called it Liberation Day, basically came out and said, oh, today we are liberating the United States from, I think, all the evil and mean spirits of the world. And we're going to basically fight back this unfair treatment that the United States has received in global trade, right? That was basically it. And then he stood out there in the Rose Garden and he held up many different tables with weirdly put together numbers on there, right? So that was the situation we were faced with on Thursday.
Yeah, and it was, so this had been coming for a long time. They had been very proudly announcing, hey, we're going to, you know, tariffs here, tariffs there. And most analysts, certainly financial analysts, as far as I'm aware, thought that it wasn't going to be that bad. They thought it was going to be okay. You know, it was going to be one of those situations where Trump says something, and then he says, well, it depends on what the others do, and he uses it as a negotiation tactic. And it was very clear that the markets and the world in general didn't expect this kind of sweeping announcement in the way that Trump did it. They believed that it was mostly going to be a tactical game rather than just the United States essentially breaking up with the world economy, because that's what they did.
Absolutely. So we had, right, so we had these tables. They looked and they were right. There was always a country name. Fun fact: Taiwan was mentioned as a country. So that was at least the United States continues its policy kind of there. And then there was a number basically put. Oh, these are the tariffs that are imposed on the United States. And then next to that was a number of this is how much we will hit back with. And the immediate reaction by everyone was, what is that number on the left? What, like, where are they getting these tariffs from?
It didn't make any sense.
No, not at all, right? But then luckily, right, there's a bunch of smart people in this world, and they all kind of, right, people looked at these numbers and tried to figure out, okay, in what, like, where in this world did the United States get the number from that Vietnam has a tariffs of 90% on the United States, because it's as far away from reality as possible. Well, the reasoning by the White House was that, it's also currency manipulation is included and other type of trade barriers. Trust us, this is a very sophisticated model, and we have figured out the real number because the world has been lying to us. Well, they very quickly figured out that it was basically the trade surplus surplus other countries had towards the United States divided by total number of imports, if I remember correctly, right? And then they came up with a number. Balder, you actually studied this, right? Is that an accurate way to kind of calculate tariffs?
Yeah, I used to be an economist in another lifetime, at least academically. Look, it's got even nothing to do with tariffs. That's the thing here. Nothing's got very little to do. There is a historical school of thought, mercantilism, and some offshoots of that from the 18th, 19th century, that inherently believes that trade deficits are bad and that it's for the government to fight trade tariffs in what, so basically you want to always export fight trade deficits, that you always want to export more than you import, the idea being that if you have a trade deficit, you import more goods than you export, then you're losing wealth, basically, right? And that is a thing from 100-200 years ago that since then has been basically debunked, or at least most economists in the 20th century and almost all economists in the 21st century believe that that is a bit of nonsense. But there is this philosophy that trade deficits are bad. And it's very clear that for some reason, the Trump administration has reinvented that wheel and have thought, hang on, we hate trade deficits. Just that's it. We don't like trade deficits. So their formula is based not on tariffs, but on trade deficits. And they're looking at Vietnam, and they're seeing that the Vietnamese actually export much more to the United States than the United States exports to Vietnam. What a surprise. Rich United States buys more goods from Vietnam. What is Vietnam going to buy from the US? Goods are way too expensive from a Vietnamese perspective. So there is a significant trade deficit that the United States has towards Vietnam, and they mistake that for a unfair trade practices, where it is just the reality of a world where a country like Vietnam simply has a lower standard of living economically and therefore obviously sends more to the US than that it is interested in buying. So it seems that the whole narrative from Trump has conflated the idea of a deficit with the idea of unfair trade practices, as if the only reason why the United States doesn't sell more goods to Vietnam is because the Vietnamese market is unfairly protected by the Vietnamese government, which is, of course, complete nonsense.
Well, to put it in numbers, right, the trade surplus Vietnam has towards the United States is 123 billion. Right, because of course Vietnam is a major producing country. A lot of the United States clothes come from there, right? Same with Cambodia, same with Bangladesh. So those are the countries that were hit particularly high from these tariffs. And exactly as you said, right? I mean, are the Vietnamese going to buy U.S. products? How? And it's not that they're closing off their markets to the U.S. in any significant way there. But that was not the right. So there were a few countries on there which are hit very hard. There were also the Penguin Islands on there. Well, not the Penguin. They're not called the Penguin Islands, right? It's the islands of McDonald and something. In the Australians will forgive me for not having the name on the top of my head. But there are no inhabitants of that on that island.
I had to look them up. I to be honest, I had no idea where they were. But and I'm pretty sure the White House doesn't know either. Now, what it shows, by the way, talking about competence and incompetence, that they focused or that they made these silly mistakes and they focused on islands that obviously should never have been on the list, is that if you are going to all of a sudden put tariffs on the whole world, you've got an enormous administrative headache in front of you. Because really, if you want to do that properly, if it's really about tariffs, you want to differentiate different goods, not just each country, because one country has different tariffs for different goods and has different trade practices for different goods. But then you're talking about tens of thousands or maybe more of calculations that you have to make. And it's very obvious that the White House had no interest in that. So basically, they just went through any list that they could find, and they just, without any thought process, without any serious consideration, just slapped tariffs on it based on that simplistic formula. Once again, this goes back to competence and incompetence, right? Just not understanding what they're doing.
Well, and also your favorite topic was involved. Right? Artificial intelligence. That a lot of this was basically done just with ChatGPT, going that, hey, here are the numbers, this is the trade deficit we have towards this country, this is how much we import from them. One more fun fact, this is only talking about manufactured goods, right? This is not talking about services, where it's actually vice versa, right? That the United States has a surplus when it comes to trading services to a lot of the world, because the United States simply is a mostly service-based economy, right? But that's something that I don't know if Trump doesn't know or he tends to ignore. I mean, well, it's more this thing of, right, we want to produce something here in the United States, right? We want to, I don't know, we want to make our own shoes.
It is emotionally, I would argue, connected to this Make America Great Again narrative of some fictitious 1950s where the United States was, you know, growing and dominating the global manufacturing world, and everyone had their car and their house and everyone was happy. I mean, that reality never existed, but that is the image that Trump has about some kind of fictional past, and that's what Make America Great Again is based on. When the United States was still a manufacturing powerhouse in a way that it isn't today. The thing that they don't seem to understand is that it is a natural process to move away from manufacturing towards services if you economically grow. And typically that's a good thing if it's well managed, because the service sector is more productive, has greater productivity, especially if the rest of the world still manufactures, right? Which is why you need China and why you need Vietnam and why you need Malaysia to basically still produce manufactured goods. Now, the one thing that politically is clear is that, unfortunately, leaders over the past 30, 40 years have not properly managed this transition in the United States or elsewhere. And therefore, you see victims of the loss of manufacturing in the United States. You see factory workers who lost their jobs and couldn't be all of a sudden trained to become Silicon Valley coders or programmers or anything like that, right? You can't just, after 30 years of working for Ford, all of a sudden become a banker in Wall Street. Those things just don't happen. And so the lack of proper leadership and proper foresight with respect to the effects of this transition has led to Trump basically milking the political fallout of this and saying, I'm going to bring manufactured goods back to the United States because we want American workers to produce again. In reality, it doesn't make any sense. There are loads of reasons. Maybe we can go into that a little bit, Dario, of why the United States should not even want to try this, and why actually the world economy has been very kind to the United States, has not been trying to abuse the United States, has not taken advantage of the U.S., but has been very, very good to U.S. growth and U.S. economic well-being. But it's clear that the, you know, Trump and probably his hardcore voters are not really interested in that kind of complexity. They're just saying the United States should be building cars, the United States should have factories full of successful workers, and we want to go back to that place.
Well, I mean, my immediate thought here was, I mean, this is a problem that you face when you don't have proper social security, right? Or a proper system that protects the workers, right? Because if a millionaire manager makes the decision to produce your cars or anything elsewhere, and then the only consequence he faces that if he lays off people is that his bonus gets increased, then of course, right? And nothing will protect the workers there, and then they will have to go into, I don't know, they will have to go to Walmart, greet people, and just feel like something, right, of their identity was taken away, right? So you've had a very respectable job for, let's say, 20, 30 years, and suddenly you're laid off because your job has moved to China, and there's no safety net, right? The United States is such a cruel society to live in. I really could not imagine what it would feel like to be there, because, yeah, you might receive some food stamps and maybe some little unemployment benefits, but that's not nearly enough in the United States. And then if you consider that most Americans do not have enough savings to kind of, right, the famous example here is always the washing machine. If their washing machine breaks down, most Americans can't fix it because they don't even have enough savings for that. Then you're just throwing people on the streets. And yeah, no, of course, they're going to be very upset with globalization. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. I think we've been understanding the story for 10 years now, but the response has never been the one of, oh, let's protect these people, let's help them somehow, but always the one of, oh, let's get their job, basically the Trump response, right? Get their job back. Let's get them back into work and into the factories, and then they will be happy again.
And of course, that is not the answer for structural reasons, because the global economy does not allow this to happen that easily. And you're absolutely right. I think a very big part of this is the lack of social security, which makes the political fallout of factory workers losing their job, the manufacturing sector being on the decline in the United States, much more significant than it would be elsewhere, exactly because of what you're saying. And the other side is, again, a underestimation from leaders in the 1990s and in the early 2000s about how easy it is to retrain the workforce, right? This idea like, yeah, we know that if China starts producing more cars, that we will lose car jobs, but that's okay because we can just retrain them to do something else. Well, that is actually really, really difficult. And if you want to do that, you have to spend significant resources on it. And even then, there are plenty of people who will never be able to be properly retrained. And so then they have to get jobs below their previous standards, right? So it's not that the United States has seen enormous unemployment. I mean, there is significant structural unemployment that the statistics don't really show in the United States because people have just stopped looking for a job, essentially. But there's also this problem that people who used to be paid, let's say, $80,000, $90,000 a year for being high up in the manufacturing world are now having to take cleaning jobs or are having to work in a restaurant, which not just isn't a huge economic problem for them, but it's also an emotional problem, right? It feels as if you go back in time. It feels as if you have to take jobs that are beneath your abilities, and that is incredibly frustrating. So this, what you described, plus what I added, is exactly the structural problem that the United States has faced. And that allows Trump to basically milk that and to say, I am going to go back to some kind of past that never actually existed. But the consequences for the United States and the rest of the world, but especially the United States, are going to be very, very severe.
And in a perverted world, where you're rolling back Social Security through Elon Musk and his cronies, right? If people are not able to make that connection between who has taken my Social Security away and people have, right, because the political elite and the establishment is blamed for having taken their jobs away. And I think you can definitely make a case as a voter, right? You can definitely make a case as a voter and say the political elite of the last 30 years took my job away and never provided me with an alternative. I'm really mad at them. I'm going to vote for Trump. Right, well, or for some radical solution. But if that radical solution now takes the little safety net you have completely away from you and doesn't get your jobs back, because this will not work, I assume, then these people get further and further disenfranchised from the system and might at some point look at China and say, well, it's working there. Maybe that's a political system that could solve my problems.
It is essential to understand that it is not just about losing jobs, but also the fact, something that we have discussed in the past, that the middle class voters in the United States have not seen a real increase in income for the past 25, 30 years, whereas the US economy has grown very significantly, right? The US economy has done very well. So it's not just that people have lost their jobs and have lost their income, but for those who didn't lose their job, who maybe were already in the financial sector or maybe already in tech, they actually haven't seen a real increase in their living standards. So it is very clear that there are large structural problems in the way that the United States, and to a lesser extent Europe, but especially the United States, functions in terms of distributing wealth, right? The wealth is created, but only very few really notice the benefit, and too many notice the downside of it. Then you get these situations, and then you get people who are just desperate for something else because this is just not working for them, and they don't want to embrace the complexity of the world economy, and they don't want to listen to an economist who says, hey, what Trump is doing is actually not the right way to help you. It's not going to help you. It's going to make life worse. No, people just say, it can't be worse than it is now, so let's just see what Trump is going to do for us with all the consequences that we are observing at the moment.
Well, it can be worse, right? The world can be made a lot worse than it actually is. And I would say here, let's go into trying to explain or trying to understand what's happening here and what's kind of driving the Trump administration there. And as always in international relations, here we've come up with a few scenarios, with five of them. And this is always my favorite part of international relations, right? Because you get to, I don't know, I always feel like a little detective who's trying to come up with different scenarios of what happened. And the first scenario is always the one that, the reason why they're doing what they're doing is because of what they're saying, right? They actually say what they're doing, right? So it's make America great again, right? So we're imposing these tariffs because we want to make America great again. We want to isolate as a little island that the United States is. We want to bring all the manufacturing jobs back to the United States. All of our voters will be, I don't know, producing shoes and cars and all these other things. And they will all have a job and we will be great again as we were in the past.
Yes, and that is basically what it says on the tin. That is what Donald Trump is claiming. And here it's probably useful to emphasize once again that as a foreign policy analyst or international relations analyst, you unfortunately do not have access to Trump's brain or his advisor's brain. You cannot be their psychologist or psychotherapist and say, lie on the couch and tell me everything you feel. So we have to kind of guess what is real and what isn't, because newsflash, sometimes politicians don't speak the truth.
What?
Yeah, no, I'm sorry, I see your shocked face. It happens sometimes. Sometimes they lie to us. It's really true. I'll give you a moment to recover. I'll just do most of the talking while you get back on your feet after this realization.
The listeners can't see this, but my face I'm having is a disappointed face.
Yeah. So we have to kind of guess, and that's why we create scenarios. And the first scenario is always, let's just assume that they speak the truth. Now, if that is the case, if they actually believe the Trump administration, and I don't think that this is what they believe, but if they actually believe that they're making America great again, this idea of isolationism, which, by the way, was kind of part of the early stages of the United States, but mostly political rather than economic, right? The United States founding fathers didn't want to be entangled in European warfare, didn't want to be part of these geopolitical games, but they were very interested in trading with the rest of the world. So, okay. If they want to go back to isolationism, they don't understand how kind the US economy has been to them, right? The global economy has been to the United States. The global economy has put the United States in a position where they can do things that no other country can, mostly because of the dollar. The the dollar as the global currency allows the United States to print money, to control trade in ways that no other country can. And by doing what the Trump administration is doing right now, is they're taking that unique position away. They're making it very hard for the United States to shape trade and global dynamics, economic dynamics in their own image, which is in the long term gonna take the United States back down. So if they're speaking the truth and they think they're making America great again, they are just idiots, because obviously they're doing the opposite.
Okay, thank you so much for taking over. I have since recovered. And I can move on with the next scenario. And that's a transactional one, right? So that it's basically, it's Trump's business administration degree from Trump University 101. You threaten them with something really extreme, and then they will give you something in return, and you're better off than before, right? And on Friday, I think I would have said, you know what? I don't think that's actually it. I mean, ultimately, it's most likely going to be a combination of all these scenarios. But we see that this is already happening and already working, specifically with countries like Vietnam and Cambodia, right? Who immediately called and said, we're so sorry, we're going to lower our non-existing tariffs and we will buy more of, I don't know, soy from your farmers. Right. So we saw that. We also, interestingly enough, we saw that with Israel, right? So Israel, before Trump announced that, actually lowered... I don't know exactly what, but Israel did something. I should have prepared better for this. But Israel did something, but it was still hit with the 10% tariff. So it really wasn't about that. But we see this in some areas, right, where countries are already, right, if they really depend on the United States, they're obviously trying to stay on their good side, right? They're not in the same negotiating position as maybe the European Union or China is. And in that sense, it's working, right? Trump is getting what he wants.
Yes, at least in the short term, it seems to be working with respect to those few countries that you mentioned. This is exactly what I referred to before, what the international markets, financial markets, IR specialists expected. It, you know, they expected the Liberation Day would be targeted tariffs that would then just be postponed for at least a month, giving countries some space to basically negotiate and basically for Trump to come out victorious and to say, look, my threats have worked. I, the art of the deal, I know how to be transactional. I know how to get a deal done. And yes, with Vietnam and some other countries, there was a reaction in that direction. The problem, of course, is that there's nothing really that Vietnam can offer. It's not all of a sudden, exactly as you hinted at. Yeah, Vietnam is not all of a sudden going to buy loads of American cars. They just don't have the disposable income for this. The idea that Trump now can take that as a political win and say to the American people, look, I have forced these countries to lower their tariffs somehow. Yeah, that's going to have some, maybe some very short term political effects. But in the long term, it's nonsensical. Economically, it doesn't put the United States in a better place. The big question is what happens to the bigger nations. And one of the things that our listeners will probably know and that we don't know yet is how the European Union is going to react on Monday and Tuesday. The interpretation of the EU not immediately reacting to the announcement is partially because the EU is expecting that this could be part of a negotiation game, that it's part of a let's readjust our trade relations in some ways, and they don't want to make things unnecessarily worse. The other part of the EU is that there are some disagreements between countries, but it is going to be very much more important and very interesting to the United States to see how the larger trading partners actually react to all of this.
Something we discussed last week with the whole Signal chat situation is, in that moment, we actually got a bit of a couch moment, right? With at least the vice president, J.D. Vance, and some of Trump's advisors. And in that Signal chat, we discovered, well, no, we didn't discover, but we had proof of how much hatred they have towards Europe and towards the European Union. And that is the kind of scenario of disconnecting from the Western alliance, right? So they want to kind of get away from Europe. They're obsessed with it. They want to punish them. They hate, right, that they are pathetic and free-loathing and all of that. And they want to punish Europe. and kind of, yeah, just disconnect from the Western alliance, a continuation of what we've already seen in the past few months.
And this has been well discussed over these past couple of months. The if you like, the oligarchic group, cabal of people surrounding Trump, right? The, you know, you've got Elon Musk, but you also have a bunch of other billionaires, the ones that were there visibly, you know, visible during the inauguration. They are looking at Europe, and Europe is their worst enemy, right? It is, there's this real sense that everything that they want to accomplish is the opposite of what Europe is. Like a strong government, strong state, protection of consumers, protection of citizens against too much oligarchy, too much power being centralized in the hands of very few. In that sense, the hatred that we see in the Signal chat and also is kind of an extension of that kind of rejection of how Europe has done things. Now, the ironic thing about all of this is that the 1950s, 1960s USA was much closer to modern day Europe than what the United States is now, right? So if you really think that Make America Great Again is somehow going back into time by 50, 60 years, then you should actually look at Europe and say, hey, this is the kind of thing we want. But of course, it's not really about going back in time for Trump and his administration and the billionaires around him. It's about creating a system where the controls are completely gone, where they can basically set the agenda in any way they like. And yeah, part of that is collapsing that connection between Europe and the United States, and to portray Europe as a potential enemy. And it is very clear that much more than Vietnam or Israel, the United States is interested in punishing Europe.
Taking this basically up a notch would be the next scenario, and that's collapsing the international system. Saying that, hey, we will break everything down and then we will build it, like rebuild it up in our own image. And that's interesting because the international system has already been created in the image of the United States and the West. But that's kind of the antichrist for the Trump administration. So for them, it's kind of rebuilding the international system, Western-based, but Western-based on their ideals, not on the ideals that were previously used.
And this, what you're describing now, is an extreme version of something that the United States has always suffered from. The United States, to some extent, has always had almost a bipolar relationship with the international system. Because, yes, they created it. It has been extremely kind to the United States because it was formed by the United States after the Second World War, when they were essentially the only game in town. So all those agreements, Bretton Woods, the transnational organization set up, the UN, everything was led and shaped by Washington, by the United States. Therefore, no other country benefited as much from that identity as the United States itself. But at the same time, the United States has always felt uncomfortable with those transnational organizations, always felt uncomfortable with the limits that they themselves imposed, and somehow believing because they were the primus inter pares, the first among equals, they were the leaders of the world, that they should not be contained by foreign structures. Like the suspicion towards the UN, all the conspiracy theories that always exist about the UN as if they're run by the Illuminati or something like that, have always been there. It's just now they, in 2025, they've gotten to a boiling point, and Trump is clearly interested in breaking that down. To what extent Liberation Day is part of that greater scheme, like, hey, through putting these tariffs everywhere, we create chaos, and through chaos, international organizations collapse. Well, the World Trade Organization is nowhere to be heard or seen at the moment, which is also interesting. So in that sense, there seems to be some success. Whether that is part of that bigger scheme, that depends on how much competence you attach to their ability to understand world affairs, right? To what extent do they have this ability to see the bigger, fuller picture and to say, hey, if we do this and we get these trade wars going and we get all this antagonism, then that will be the end of global organizations. I'm not fully convinced that they have that ability.
Well, because that's our last scenario, and that's complete incompetence, right? Is that they are, I mean, if we look at the format that they used, that they are just complete idiots. They're utter and complete idiots, and they don't know what they're doing, and they think they're doing like this big thing, and right, everyone's looking at them kind of confused, really concerned that they're destroying a lot right now. But then ultimately, yeah, I mean, this is just going to lead to a further demise of the United States, and they are selling it as a win.
Well, this was the theme from last week's episode about Signal. Besides any moral questions about how comfortable you are with killing civilians in a foreign country and stuff like that, just the pure incompetence of Signal is now once again highlighted, at the very minimum, in the way that this has all been represented, right? The way that they talk about this. The people going onto American media, onto American TV, to explain on behalf of the Trump administration what is happening, seem to have absolutely no clue about how the world economy works. To me, it is completely obvious that even if some of these other scenarios might also be partially true, right? Scenarios can be mixed together. At the foundation of all of this is a very, very clear incompetence. They do not listen to proper economists. There's not an economist in the world who would argue that what they did in their calculation with their silly little formula makes any economic sense, which means that all of this policymaking was done without the input of serious economists. That is a sign of complete incompetence. And it frustrates me so much when I get sent a TikTok video or something else like that. I don't have TikTok myself, but people do keep on bothering me with social media. Where someone basically claims that this is the genius of Trump and he's looking way ahead. And for example, this is a way for them to lower interest rates so that they can more easily pay off U.S. debt. Or that this is a way for, you know, the people who are critical of Trump, that he does this in order to enrich himself and his fellow billionaires. Will there be some insider trading? Will some billionaires be able to take advantage of this chaos? Of course it will. Of course they will. But don't tell me that Trump and the administration have the ability to control the enormous chaos that they're creating, because they don't even understand it, let alone know how to manipulate it in any proper way.
Well, and all of this is leading to the price the United States is paying here. And that's basically another step towards the United States losing its leadership position and destroying the system that they have set up themselves and that has made them so strong and successful.
Yeah, and this is the thing that it seems that the average American citizen doesn't understand, that the problems that the United States is facing, and there are significant problems, no doubt about it, are not because of an evil foreign world out there. They're not because the global system has been taking advantage of the United States. The opposite, the global system has been kind to the United States, but there have been over the past 30 years, not just Trump, not just Biden, it goes way back, there has been bad policy making in terms of understanding the changes of our global reality, understanding the changes of how you engage in good governance if you're in Washington. And most importantly, how do you protect vulnerable groups in a world where big money, financial flows, centralized power among very few? Those are the problems that need to be asked. And that's got nothing to do with global trade. It's got nothing to do with global organizations. In fact, global trade and global organizations could help you fight the uglier elements of this system that we are witnessing. And it seems that your average US citizen doesn't get this message. They do see the pain that 2025 is inflicting among themselves. And they want something to be done. And what do you do in a case like that? You blame the outsider. You blame the foreigner. You blame the system that is there that doesn't anymore seem to cooperate with your well-being. And as a result, the United States is giving up their enormously powerful and influential and beneficial position in global affairs, and they will get absolutely nothing in return.
Well, this seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on the Trump tariffs. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Baldur, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
I chose a quote from Federico Fellini that I actually specifically looked for. Of course, Fellini, the great Italian filmmaker. Because I knew it existed, and I found it after a bit of Googling. And I must say that the irony of it hasn't escaped me, because I'm saying this as a podcaster that, who is basing our existence on, and as a professor who's basing their existence off speaking. But Fellini makes a good point here, namely by saying, "I think television has betrayed the meaning of democratic speech, adding visual chaos to the confusion of voices. What role does silence have in all this noise?"